Welcome to Pharmaceutical Executives Leadership Series with corporate strategy expert Ken Banta. Ken is CEO of the Vanguard Network, the membership and consulting organization for C-suite executives. I'm Mike Christel, Group Managing Editor at MJH Life Sciences. In this episode, we are joined by Andrew Hall, the CEO of Consano Bio, where the discussion explores today's formula for biotech leaders in managing that critical balance of innovation and risk. Kicking off part one of our conversation, Andrew provides a quick update on Consano's hopeful drug candidate for chronic sciatica, which recently entered phase one.
We've just opened a study to be 30 patients by the time it's done, three cohorts, first trial of this new therapeutic category in people. So we'll see what happens. We're measuring everything from safety through efficacy to some biomarker and nerve conductivity stuff. So it'll be a good challenge to see what we can get out of a small study. But, you know, if it reads positively, the whole field changes, which is wonderful.
Awesome. Yeah, good luck with that. It's a first in class candidate, right?
Correct. We've got a disease modifier for nerve damage. So the first trial population is in radicular pain, so pain stemming from damaged spinal nerves. So sciatica, you'd know it as, but when it gets into a chronic state, you actually see proper nerve damage, and we're going in and giving a local catalyst for cellular recovery, and hopefully it'll be manifesting in patient benefit.
Andrew's been a great participant with Vanguard for a couple of years now, several years, and it's been fun to watch you go from Andrew's sort of let's hope it happens to something happening. Or not just hope, but you know, we don't know. Yeah. We hope we press through it will, so that's great.
We now dig into our discussion where first off, Ken and Andrew share what they believe are the elements of powerful leadership most important to success in the life sciences today.
So my observation is that you know, maybe now more than ever in this very chaotic environment, the role of the life sciences CEO is, you know, to have a very high level of, you know, what's called emotional intelligence or EQ. It's the ability to lead a team in a non-hierarchical way. So to lead, you know, through persuasion and influence, not by dictates, because you know, a lot of people don't respond very well to that, especially actually, interestingly, scientific people especially don't like it. They're very, you know, they can be quite operatic people themselves. And so, you know, it's important to have a really good touch and be able to read the room in a way in that sense. And, you know, also sometimes there's a larger team beyond the top team. And, you know, you need to be able to inspire those people and help them see, you know, see kind of the hope of the future for the product. And especially in today's environment, it's really incumbent on the CEO to be that sort of point of stability and to be that point of encouragement for people, which, you know, is related to the science, but it's not about the science, it's about the people. So to me, that's maybe at least one key factor. But I mean, personally, I think Andrew kind of exemplifies that, but maybe he has a different view.
So I've been a CEO of a public company in crisis. I've started a company now. I think the most powerful thing you can be as a CEO is a cheerleader for everyone's effort. And that goes two ways. That goes, you know, you then take accountability for the bad. You need to be the one who stands in front of the board and the shareholders when things aren't going so well and saying, this is on me. You know, even though it's an organizational accountability, as the CEO, you are the one who stands up and actually says, I lead and I take accountability. And that sort of goes in almost reverse. When it goes well, your obligation is to pass it down through the organization. And so it feels as if it's almost a role as a hiding to nothing, because when it's bad, you're accountable. And when it's good, you are a pass through. I have this wonderful group of individuals that work with me, and far too many of them have MIT PhDs and are far smarter and more competent and more capable in so many levels. But the one thing that I can bring to that group, and it's not on a level of scientific authority or scientific acumen or scientific alacrity even, it's I can take what they give me and I can pass it into digestible messaging. I can take what they put together and create an organizational strategy to it. And I can take what it is we are developing and create meaningful utility to a broader audience. And all of those elements, you look across biotech, and I agree with you, Ken. So many of the scientific founders that become CEOs get so lost in the mechanism and forget the sort of the forest through the trees. And I do believe the best CEOs, they set culture, they keep people accountable, they take accountability for organizational pluses and minuses, and they cheerlead. And I think if you get those four things in a CEO and the science is good, you typically get a pretty decent outcome.
Yeah, it makes sense. Yeah, Andrew, like from your vantage point, you're a biotech leader, early stage projects. So, by nature, you deal with a lot of unknowns, right? And from science to funding, right, to regulation, all that stuff. So in that case, what mindsets matter most when that path isn't necessarily clear? Like your messaging and all that.
Such a good question, Michael. The first thing you have to be cool with, I think, in this space, particularly in an early one, is just missing a few days of sleep here and there as these uncertainties play to you. A gentleman who I took wonderful mentorship once upon a time told me that if you can't compartmentalize being a CEO and having a life, then you won't be able to do it well. There does need to be a certain dissociation. But the risk, the uncertainty is what biotech is. If there was no uncertainty and no risk in this, every company that started would be worth $1 billion and people would just, there would be nothing to worry about. The reality is, when you start something, you have to look forward enough into the future to understand when those risks happen, when those risks are going to get taken off the table, and when those risks are still on the table, they create a discount on value, but they create an opportunity for you to overcome. And a drug development mindset is you start with the end in mind, but then you appreciate all of the binaries that you'll go through in that pathway. Can you find the right binding on the target? Can you find the right safety on the molecule? Can you find the right specificity on the outcome? All of these things bundle into the is the risk worth the reward in the end? And as you start to take risk off the table, as we've been able to do in the last couple of years, we've taken off the risk of can we successfully scale and make it? Can we prove it to be safe in non-clinical modeling? Can we show in non-clinical models that there is a benefit? Can you satisfy all of the regulators that it goes into clinic? And now the binary we're at is when it's in a small clinical population, do you see benefit? If we see yes there, the next population question will be in a larger population. All of these things are the purpose of what you're doing it for, which is the risk exists for you and your management team and your leadership to find ways to overcome. And if you fail and you don't overcome those risks, something I learned at Celgene very early on is fail fast. Find out those risks early so you're not burning investor capital through to something that you should have probably known to kill years and years ago. And so that mindset of seeing the risks, confronting them, and then finding the right people to get over them is what biotech is. And Michael, you talked a little about the capital risk that is always there. That is always a risk, and there is always macros that you can't change, but then you kind of work with the situations you're in. When we started the company, it wasn't particularly interesting to strategic capital, so we lent really heavily into high net worth private individual family offices, and we created a wonderful way to capitalize an organization to a point. But you have to keep in mind, what's the next step? What's the next risk that comes off the table? What's the next value inflection point? How does that change the company? Who's going to be interested? And that's a little bit of the separation of church and state. You want your scientists focused on get the outcome, and then you want the CEO and maybe the CFO or the CEO and one other to start thinking about what does that actually mean on the larger level, and what's the environment that we're raising in? And that risk of can you capitalize good innovation is still a real question. When money flows into biotech, the whole industry rises. You've seen the XBI go from 70 to now nearly 130. There's a whole lot of reasons to feel good about it. But as we talked about with Ken at the opening, there are a lot of companies not getting access to that funding because it's still going to the blue chips, going to the big financings, going to the big M&A events, and it hasn't pulled all the way down to say getting capital for good innovation is easy because it just isn't.
Even though you do read and you do see some analysts are saying that the big pharma still has a lot of capital, right, at the ready for these sort of deals, but they're still not tapping those
I mean, they're
necessarily.
putting it to work. There's been a number of sort of multi-billion dollar acquisitions, and these are the ones that make everyone feel good. What you really want to see which is the lifeblood of biotech, is $30 to $50 million Series A's led by good venture. And that's still not happening as much. There's big follow-ons, big Series B's, big Series C's. So there is some injection of capital into biotech, but the higher risk, the earlier stage, the less traditional type therapeutics, still struggling in this environment.
You're seeing more of the bolt-on sort of safer
That's
acquisition,
right.
right? Phase three
Yeah. It was a
sorts of
joke.
thing.
This time last year, it was AI and obesity and maybe a bispecific.
Yeah.
This year, I think obesity has sort of sailed a little, so it's more neurodegeneration. AI is still a curiosity, and there's some lean back into cancer, but there's also some trend in large disease states, cardiometabolics come back on. We're in
Yeah.
pain, and there seems to be some enthusiasm for pain as a disease state. But again, unless you're blue chip and easy, capital's still hard to find.
Does it still come down to, I mean, I know it's simple to say, but your assets differentiation.
I mean, Michael, where we
You
started, the risk that's left on the table is the differentiator of the ability to grow into massive value. And obviously, the multiplier is higher the earlier you get on. And so I think there is still a legacy of the biotech winter falling through a lot of the large venture firms, which is, the LPs just, they're still working to get out of some of the investments that they've made historically. And so they're looking for, if I can only get a 5x out of my investment by taking a more de-risked deal later, rather than going after a 50x from an earlier deal, there's still that tendency to more probable return with a less large multiplier than the reverse. And I think that's really the innovation quotient that 2026 is going to bleed out. Do you see investment going into the higher risk, less certain, more value returning investments? And that's those 50 to 30 to $50 million Series A's.
And I think it might be right to say, Andrew, too, that part of the risk equation here is a new risk element, which is the FDA. And so
Yeah.
previously, the FDA was a given. You knew how it was going to operate. You understood the parameters. You just had to see if what you had would go through the machinery properly. But now it's a wild card. And I think, my impression at any rate is that one of the reasons that investors are still cagey about these, the more innovative opportunities is because they have no idea what's going to happen with that in this FDI. I mean, is it going to be treated as a vitamin? Is it going to be treated as anything at all? Is there going to be anybody in that division when you show up to
Will the
dispense
FDA
the drug?
approve vaccines? I mean,
Yeah,
there's this chaos
whatever.
going on in that space at the moment.
And so it's and when you have the regulator in a state of chaos, it's not a good thing for innovation.
Agree wholeheartedly with that. And that's at the most critical point, right? When all of the investment and hard work has gone into showing something works clinically, if you take it in front of the regulators and you don't have certainty that a good clinical product with a safe, tolerable profile doesn't get approved because of regulatory chaos, that's just another one of those uncertainties you throw into the risk matrix.
And I think that's another dimension of this leadership element as well, which is that really good CEOs of these smaller innovative companies have to really rethink their approach to a lot of stuff, including basics like, do we have something here that we can push into the FDA? Perhaps 5 years ago, we would have felt there was a reasonable odds that we'll get somewhere. Now those odds may have decreased by 30-40%. And so part of the judgment call for the CEO is on a leadership front is can I sort of to what Andrew was describing earlier, do we fight or fold on a certain thing? And to make that judgment quite early with very little clear information. It might be that in reality you would get through this FDA with what you have, but can you risk it? And that's a whole new calculation, a whole new element of three-dimensionality about the decision making that is also totally unnecessary.
Andrew, do you see FDA though trying to kind of, do you see them making any efforts to sort of help smooth that process a little bit? You see them kind of profess some flexibility in approval pathways and things of that nature.
Michael, they're trying really. I mean, they did a listening tour through the United States where, Marty and his team sat down with biotech CEOs and pharma CEOs to say, let's, this space is not great where it sits in the US regulatory environment right now. Let's hear from the customers as to, maybe some things that they can think about. I attended one of those. I think the conversation was productive. You've obviously seen some work that's been put through to say that a 12-month PDUFA review period is ridiculous. Let's see if we can shorten it to a month. That might also be ridiculous. But there's efforts to say that it's cumbersome, it's not as functional as it needs to be, and some things are being confronted about the FDA. The frustration I have living in the environment is it's almost like let's blow it up and start it again. So that's the uncertainty Ken's talking about this year and last year, that there isn't full functionality as all of these changes happen. Now, I do believe that the FDA will be a better vehicle with some changes that are being suggested. Living through it this year and last year, it's tough. And there are companies, including my own, that are considering the FDA as a nice to have rather than a must have, particularly as we go into early clinic, because there are easy regular easier, and this isn't a representative of, a less safe product, but just through process and confidence in outcome, there are better regulators to start with, and there are incentives to do clinic outside of the United States, particularly at an early stage, that a lot of companies are now taking advantage of. And the US is the innovation economy, right? It doesn't feel that it fits the narrative of the administration if the FDA is actually discouraging innovation to start in the United States.
Ken, you had mentioned that in our last conversation, right? The appeal now more of conducting trials in China, for instance, and things like that, right?
Yeah, I think there seem to be two trends underway, and Andrew will know better than I do if this is correct. But one of them is that it's increasingly attractive to go to other countries, to the EU, to Australia, to other places for approvals. And meantime, China in particular appears to have really become a more of an innovation engine than people ever expected. It's now not just a place you go to get, pro forma things done or to, kind of do me too type products. There's actually more and more stuff happening and very and much faster than here. And potentially with the opportunity to have an approval process in China that no one would have even imagined being, important, but now it may be. And there's potentially a sort of tectonic shift in power, really, and impact in biopharma that is not good for the U.S. as a from a national point of view, and not good for U.S. innovation either.
I agree with all of that.